WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. What if we could block a protein to stop runaway cell division? Dana-Farber laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, it's Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast. It's Monday, June 6th. The United States Labor Department, if you missed it on Friday, gave good news and bad news for American workers, depending on how you look at it. The good news, employers added 390,000 jobs in May in what is now a pattern of 17 straight monthly gains. That's 17, according to stats in the New York Times, and 390,000 jobs net plus in May was actually pretty much more than they were expecting. Unemployment is right around a 50-year low of 3.6%. But that good news for workers, as many of you know, is presenting a continued challenge for policymakers because they're trying to pump the brakes on inflation at the same time. So here's President Biden delivering remarks on the May jobs report on Friday.
The point is this. We've laid an economic foundation that's historically strong, and now we're moving forward to a new moment where we can build on that foundation. Build a future of stable, steady growth so we can bring down inflation without sacrificing all the historic gains we've made.
The president on Friday. So here's a question, and let me take a shot at framing the conundrum that policymakers face, and then we'll hear what our guest thinks. Can't we keep wage growth going so badly needed after decades of middle-class wage stagnation, really the decline of the middle class, as a result, and still tame other aspects of inflation? Joining me now to break down the latest job numbers, the state of the economy generally, and to address this, quote, new moment that President Biden was talking about on Friday and this conundrum is Gina Smilek, reporter covering the Federal Reserve and the economy for The New York Times. Hi, Gina. Thanks for coming on today and starting off the week with us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Gina, where do you start? What's your headline from Friday?
Yeah, so this is a very strong labor market, and it is probably not one that is sustainable over time. I think that is sort of the big takeaway. So as you alluded to, we're seeing this very strong wage growth, which, as you mentioned, we hadn't seen for a very long time. And so this is something workers can sort of take heart in. At the same time, that wage growth is not keeping up with inflation. We are seeing really rapid inflation. And I think one thing that worries the Fed is historically, when you have really rapid wage increases, you can get into a situation where wages and prices start to sort of chase one another. So you see workers who have a little bit of power in this labor market bargaining up their pay because they're trying to cover these rising prices. At the same time, companies have a little bit of pricing power because, you know, it's very hard to raise your prices when the guy next door isn't, but when the guy next door is, it's easy to kind of, you know, eke a little bit of extra out there. And so companies with pricing power who are also facing rising labor costs might be more likely to pass those rising labor costs on along to customers. And so you can get into sort of this upward spiral where wages and prices feed one another. And that is what the Fed is very worried about. We don't see signs of that right now. In fact, wage growth moderated just a little bit. So if you were, you know, very worried that we were already in a wage price spiral, this report was probably good news for you. But I don't think we're out of the woods yet either, because we still are seeing this very rapid, historically unusual pace of wage increases.
So the headline on one of your articles is wages climb briskly, good news, good news for workers, but a challenge for policy. What is the challenge for policy?
I think the challenge for policy is how do we set down this economy, sort of cool it off enough that wages moderate to a sustainable level and that inflation comes down to a place where it's not outstripping wages so that everyone can actually end up being better off without actually tipping the economy into a recession. And that is a very tricky problem for the Fed because it's they work with interest rates, they raise interest rates, they increase the cost of borrowing across the economy in order to slow down demand and hiring and wage growth. And that's a very blunt tool. It's very hard to do it with any precision. And so I think they are really grappling with how to cool things off in a way that sets it on a sustainable path without overdoing it to the point that we all end up in a really sort of, you know, pretty painful economy for a while here.
And there are a few different pieces that I want to dig into a little bit. One is the historic wage stagnation that we're dealing with, what I call the decline of the middle class in the intro. And if you can put any numbers on that. Another thing is where the inflation is coming from, whether it's necessary for all these producers of things and sellers of things to keep up in some way, or whether it's greed. Your colleague, I'll note, Lydia DePillis, recently wrote about the term greedflation, which you tweeted about. She writes, there is not much disagreement that many companies have marked up goods in excess of their own rising costs, unquote. And so can you talk about greedification and whether anybody can actually measure it and therefore crack down on it?
Well, I think greedflation is actually a somewhat controversial topic. And I think it's controversial for a couple of reasons. So like Lydia mentioned, there's not much disagreement that companies are increasing their profits by more than they need to in order to cover, you know, they're raising prices by more than they need to in order to cover their rising labor costs. That is true. But I think there's real question about whether that is unusual or something that needs to be fixed, or whether this is just kind of the way the economy works. And just to unpack that a little bit, in a capitalist society like the one we have, you know, companies are profit seeking. They try and expand their profits. That's why you invest in Google or Microsoft, because you trust Google or Microsoft to try and grow their profits. That's basically how the system works. And so this is consistent with what we would expect to see in an environment where companies can swell their profit margins. You know, if they can charge more, they will charge more. That's sort of logical. The question is whether this is going to last over time, because in standard economic theory, you would expect companies that are swelling their profit margins in a way that is sort of unsustainable like this to be competed out of the market. So, you know, the milk shop down the street raises its prices to $4 from $2, even though its costs have only gone up a little. A new milk shop should open up and charge way less in order to steal away all the customers. The question is whether that's going to happen or whether something has broken down in that chain. And so it does seem like we're seeing this moment of corporate profit taking. I think the jury is out on whether that's going to last and on whether it actually requires a policy response, and on whether a policy response could be nimble enough, whether we could do something with policy that would be fast enough to deal with this sort of, you know, greedflation and inflation issue in the moment and in a quick enough way for it to matter to people. So right. I think it's an evolving story. I don't think we have all the answers on this one yet.
Well, could, and maybe this is a radical thought, and maybe people aren't supposed to ask this question anytime over the last 50 years, but is there any system of price controls that guarantees the private sector producers of very in-demand goods enough profit that they still have an incentive to produce as much as needed, as much as they can sell, still very capitalist, but doesn't let them gouge people just because there's a lot of demand in the moment, but not tamp down wages at the same time?
I think that we have... I imagine that would be very difficult to figure out. I've never heard of such a system. I don't think that's sort of, I think the way most economists would approach this is that market forces, while it is important to have government sort of policing and regulation of companies that might make short-term decisions that don't make sense for a broader society, market forces do work pretty effectively at sort of signaling to companies like, how much to produce and how much demand is out there in the economy and how much we really need of any given thing. You know, the economy in America is pretty nimble, actually. It is pretty typically pretty good at responding to supply and demand signals. Really, what we've seen over the last couple of years is a breakdown in that ability to adjust to supply and demand signals because of trends related to the pandemic. So, you know, a big part of the reason we have the inflation we have today is that sort of producers, companies, haven't been able to sort of ramp up their supply of cars or computers or, you know, what have you. Houses are a great example, because we have just had a lot of shortages that tied to early pandemic factory lockdowns, that tied to supply chain snarls, that tied to all of these supply side factors. And so, you know, in a world with price controls, that wouldn't necessarily fix those problems. You still would have too few things. In a world without price controls, in theory, the higher prices should attract new companies into the market, get them producing, and allow those shortages to sort of alleviate over time.
TJ in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, TJ.
Morning to you and to your guest. Tina, I want to ask you something. Inflation is not the most dangerous thing here. Inflation could be even good for business, at least initially. I think the danger is what's called stagflation, which we've seen in the 70s. That means inflation and stagnation. And are we likely to go into that route?
TJ, thank you very much. And here come the 1970s again, just when even baby boomers would probably rather leave them behind. But Gina, how about that term, which dates from the 70s, stagflation?
Right, the dreaded stagflation. I think this is going to be the biggest debate in economics this year is, are we headed for a stagflationary environment? Because what we know is that the Fed is slowing down the economy deliberately to try and control inflation. Sort of naturally, it follows that we're going to have a period where the economy is slowing down, but inflation is still high because it takes some time for that chain reaction to really play out. And so it does seem likely that we're going to have a period of slower growth and rapid inflation. Whether that constitutes stagflation, though, is a big open question. And I think the answer most economists would give is it has to last for a while. We need to get in a situation where these things are both true and they're kind of feeding on one another for it to really be a stagflationary episode. And I think, you know, you'll talk to a lot of economists these days who say, certainly the risks of a stagflation have gone up. It is absolutely the case that we could end up in that situation. However, it is just too soon to tell whether it's actually going to happen or not. And a lot sort of hinges on what happens next, not just with Fed policy, but also with luck, you know, because we have had a situation recently where we have not had great luck when it comes to inflation. You know, we had these supply chain issues. We had all the port backups and all the shipping problems.
Pandemic related, more or less.
Exactly. Pandemic related, China's policies of locking down to control COVID have very much exacerbated them. And then we got hit with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which, while more acutely felt in Europe, has been a major inflationary shock here in the United States as well, because it's pushed up food prices, it's pushed up fertilizer prices, it's pushed up all kinds of commodity oil and gas prices. And so, you know, if our luck continues to be pretty bad, you know, the risks of stagflation definitely increase. If our luck improves, maybe that risk is diminished.
So stagflation would be if, and for you as a Federal Reserve correspondent, I guess we're expecting the Fed to push interest rates up another full point this summer, maybe even a point and a half by September. And if they do that, that's supposed to make the cost of borrowing to invest in your business or to buy a house so expensive that the rate of growth of the economy slows down. That's the stag part. But the inflation rate also slows down because businesses aren't growing as fast. Demand isn't there as it is right now, and more meets supply more evenly, so prices wouldn't keep growing. So why did it happen in the past that if the Federal Reserve Board did increase interest rates, and interest rates got crazy high in the late 70s, early 80s, they got into the teens. You know, we're talking about like 2%, 3% interest rates now as being huge. Interest rates got into the teens. And yet the inflation continued. Tell us a little more about why that happened.
Right. So I would say that at least some of that episode came down to bad luck. You know, we saw a situation where, yes, interest rates were going up a lot, but at the same time, we were hit by repeated commodity shocks. So we had oil embargoes, and we had the sort of ricocheting of those higher oil prices through the broader economy. And so there was a situation where higher prices were partially just sort of drawing the short stick. It was also the case in the 1970s, and I think this is a really, really important nuance. It was the case in the 1970s that inflation had been high for a very long time. Inflation really started to ratchet up during the 1960s. And then we basically went through most of the 1970s without the Fed taking really decisive, really painful action to control inflation. Not until Paul Volcker took over in the early 1980s did the Fed move interest rates up to those very punishing levels that you uh-huh. just mentioned. Uh-huh. And so I think what we saw happen in that era was consumers and businesses and basically everybody across the economy began to expect much higher inflation year after year. So when unions were negotiating wage packages, they were trying to beat the inflation level. When households were talking about wages with their own bosses, they were trying to beat the inflation level. And anytime a company was setting its pricing policies, it was doing that with this high inflation rate in mind, knowing that its input costs and its labor costs were likely to go up. And so we did get into that cycle I was talking about earlier, where wages and prices fed on one another. And that inflationary psychology made it a lot harder to sort of crush inflation out of the economy, which meant that it required a longer period of slow growth and really painful economic effect in order to wrestle inflation back under control. I think the hopeful story you can tell about today is that has not been the case. People generally seem to understand why we've had this high inflation, which is these sort of unlucky one-offs tied to the pandemic. You see some indications that consumer psychology around inflation is changing, but certainly it doesn't seem likely that it's changed the way it did over the course of the entire 1970s this quickly. And so the sort of hopeful story you can tell yourself is the Fed might be able to sort of get us into this soft landing more easily than it was obviously capable of doing that in the 1970s and 1980s.
I mentioned at the beginning that there's what you'll tell me if you disagree, has been middle class decline in this country for decades and concentration of income in the top 20% or so. It's not just the top 1%, like people say. To some degree, it's like crazy in the top 0.1% and 1%. But I think it's also that the top 20% is running away with most of the wages and everybody's been falling behind. And in a Times article by your colleague, Lydia DePillis, who we mentioned before, one notable feature of the economic recovery since the pandemic that she pointed out has been the low unemployment rate among disadvantaged classes of workers as a good thing. She writes, April, for example, was the first time since 1972, here comes that decade again, that a higher share of Black people of all ages were working or looking for work than the average. Last month, participation by Black people grew to 63%. So with a 50-year frame, what are we looking at in terms of increasing inequality, decline of the middle class, that we want to be rooting for the economy to correct?
Right. So I think it's really important to talk about the two kinds of inequality here. So there's income inequality, which is the amount you earn. And income inequality has gotten a lot worse over the last 4 or 5 decades. And then there's wealth inequality, which is the amount of savings you have. It's things like stocks and housing wealth. And that has just exploded over the last 40 to 50 years. So there are two distinct kinds of inequality. They obviously relate to one another, but I think it's important to sort of like lay out the difference right at the top. What we're seeing right now is a situation where income inequality, that earnings inequality, has actually narrowed a bit in the last couple of years, which is a real change in trend because of this very strong labor market, because we are seeing workers regain some amount of bargaining power. I think there are real questions about whether that can last. And it also matters whether you're thinking about it as sort of a nominal, so pre-inflation adjusted or after inflation adusted basis. Those things all come into play. But I think what we can say unequivocally is that if you are a disadvantaged worker in this labor market, you probably have opportunities that you haven't had in decades because employers are just so desperate to hire. And because employers are really sort of reassessing the way that they treat marginalized workers in this environment, you know, at a moment when there are 1.9 job openings for every unemployed and active job seeker, employers are starting to have to think, you know, do I really need that college degree in order to hire this person? Do I really care if this person has, you know, maybe a minor criminal infraction on their background? And so you're seeing a moment where I think a bunch of people might get sucked into the labor market, be given opportunities, and have that last in sort of a positive way. The economists call this positive hysteresis, where sort of a period of very strong labor markets can actually leave people with a lasting positive legacy. So that could be very good news from an inflation standpoint. At the same time, we have, until recently, we had seen a big run-up in stocks during the pandemic, and that's bad for the other side of the equation, which is wealth inequality. The reason that's so bad is because stocks make up a big share of the wealth of the richer classes, but very, very few people in the bottom half of the income and wealth distribution hold any stocks at all. And when they do hold stocks, they don't hold a lot. And so anytime you see the stock market really rallying, you see a big divide in wealth inequality. And so, you know, in as much as stocks are falling now, that's probably actually good for wealth inequality in the sense that it will make it smaller. But so anyway, so those are two sort of different dynamics that we've seen playing out in this post-pandemic era.
All right. Thanks for that clear description. One of the primary questions of our times, how to keep wages continuing to catch up with history without inflation continuing to run out of control. Conundrum upon conundrum for policymakers right now, and obviously an issue for a platform for competing ideas in the midterm election season that is just beginning. My guest has been Gina Smilek, reporter covering the Federal Reserve and the economy for the New York Times. Gina, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.